St. George's number one station with Washington County's top talk show. The Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Welcome to the program, 909 on KDXU. Thanks for tuning in today as it is a water day. Well, it's not watery outside, it's watery inside because Zach Renstrom is here, the Washington County Water Conservancy District Manager. And, there's Carrie, too. She's rolling in. Hi, Carrie. We should turn her microphone and ask her why she was late.
That's a good question.
I don't want to get you in trouble, Carrie, with the boss here. So, Zach, thanks for coming on the show, man. It's good to see you.
It's always good to be here.
I have been exploring your website for the last half an hour, and I guess Carrie's the one that puts that bad boy together. Way to go, Carrie. Pretty cool website.
Well, thanks.
A couple of cool links to look at. One of them is infrastructure, and there's a cool color-coded wheel. And we'll talk about your infrastructure in just a little minute, but we were talking about the difficulty in modern times right now of hiring people, getting people to come, especially from out of the area, and live here. Mm-hmm. Imagine you got a job, and let's say I'm just throwing a random number, Zach, but say you've got a job to offer somebody that pays $65,000 a year, and they're from, say, Tucson or whatever, and they say, okay, that sounds okay, I can do that, and then they get here, and they try to find a place to live, and they're looking at townhomes that are $400,000, they're looking at single-family homes that are $500,000 or worse, and I guess that's a real issue.
Yeah, and I know at the Water District, we have made multiple offers to individuals for employment, and they've turned us down. Mm. Because they come here and they start looking, and they says, yeah, we just can't afford it. And so they either ask for a lot more money, which we're not able to provide
can't
to
do,
them,
yeah.
Or they just turn us down and not come here. But I know a lot of the other government entities are facing this. I know in talking to a lot of people in the private sector, they share the same stories. They're really struggling to find good employees too. And so it's a unique time right now, that's for sure.
One of the things that I struggled with was when they started offering people with no skills to work at a local restaurant $14, $15 an hour. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a problem with them making that money, except the fact that someone like me who has a college degree, who has 30 years of experience in my field, is not making a whole lot more than that. And going, wait a second, if the bottom end is getting that much closer to where I'm at, shouldn't my end of it thing be bumped that much higher? And of course, like you said, in the private sector, more so than the government, they, you know, we can't do that. We can't pay you that, or we'll go out of business.
Yeah. And so, one of the things that we're really facing, really, like we purchase a lot of things, of course. And so like we purchase a lot of chemicals. The cost of our chemicals have doubled.
Wow.
And of course we use a lot of chemicals, and that's very tough. And so we reach out and we talk to the distributors and try to figure out every little way we can get it a little bit cheaper, but that's kind of what it's going for. So just this inflation is just killing everybody, and I have my political views on who to blame for that, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
but I won't share those. But it's very tough, and I don't see it slowing down anytime soon. So it's going to be tough for a while.
So when it comes to the what is maybe the number one chemical you purchase the most at the Water District?
So we purchase polymers, which is there's three main chemicals that we really purchase. I mean, we purchase a lot of other things, but one of the things that we purchase is it's basically activated carbon, and that helps take out pollutants, taste, odor, and things like that out of the water. Then we use another one that's a flocculant, where basically it acts like a magnet, and so when we have silt in the water, you put this chemical in there, and it just starts collecting all that silt and getting it, and then it drops. It gets heavy, and then it drops to the bottom. We skim it out.
Nice.
What was the third? Oh, yeah. Activated carbon, and then just some of our disinfectant things. So we're actually fortunate because at our water treatment plant, we actually create our own chlorine, which is it was interesting because when it was installed, it was kind of rare, and it was very expensive. But it's saving us a fortune, and especially when during COVID, when there were a lot of supply chain issues, there were certain entities that were panicking over chlorine, and we didn't have that issue. But we still actually do purchase a lot of chlorine for other things, for like our individuals and stuff like that. And so, So these, it's expensive.
These chemicals that you do buy, are there choices? Like, can you bid that out and say we're going to switch providers if you keep raising your prices? Or is there pretty much one provider and you're stuck with it?
No, there's multiple providers, but there's only like maybe two in the United States. And when it comes to drinking water, they have to meet certain requirements and safety standards. And so it's not like something we can go to another country and say, like India, and say, ship it in. If we were going to purchase that chemical from India, it would have to come here, and then we have to make sure that it meets the purity and test it and stuff like that. Where if we purchase it within the United States, we know that that chemical we're getting is already meeting certain requirements. And so there's always that nervous feeling about purchasing that. But then there's just not a lot of it. Like, I mean, I don't know how many people are really purchasing like thousands of tons of activated carbon charcoal.
Probably not a lot of us.
And even with that, there's different kinds. And so what we do is we take our water and we'll run it through like 10. So when we go out for a bid, we'll say, well, if you want us to buy it, give us a sample. And then they'll give us a sample. And then we'll run our local water through that sample. And then we'll test it and we'll say, hey, for some reason, this charcoal is doing a lot better job than this charcoal. Hmm. And so we found out like the coconut charcoal works really well for our water.
Coconut charcoal.
Yeah. That's how they activated carbon.
Like a tropical drink. Yeah.
No, it's not that. It's the shells. Anyways, but for some reason, that same powder may not do very well for a plant, let's say in Tennessee. And it's just because of the chemical makeups and certain things like that. And so we always test the chemicals that come in. We test which ones work best for our water. And there is some variabilities there that we can do it. But then it comes at a cost, because if we use a different activated carbon, we might have to use twice as much to get the same effects as if we buy it a little bit more expensive. And it's always one of those things that one of the reasons why we have a lab at the water treatment plant is we're always running these tests and looking at things we can do to tweak it.
We don't even think about that stuff. Most of us, we just turn the water on and hope it tastes good and doesn't kill us.
Well, you don't. I know I'm doing my job right, and the water district's doing their job right, is when you don't think about it.
Yeah.
When you turn on the water and it tastes nasty, then you'll think about it, and that's when we're not happy.
And that's something I was going to bring up. I stayed up in Provo. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was Orem, I guess, technically, this last week for the baseball playoffs, and I didn't like the taste of their water. Mm-hmm. And is it a matter of you get used to a certain taste in your water, or is it a matter of some water just doesn't taste very good and they don't care that much about the taste?
A little bit of both. So our water here actually is pretty good. I know every once in a while we get a complaint about it, but for the most part, where we get our water from is really nice, pristine aqua watersheds. Mm-hmm. So you think of Zions National Park. I mean, 60% of our drinking water comes through Zions National Park. And you look above there, and there's some ranching and a couple of cabins, but for the most part, you don't have a lot. In some of these areas, you might have a major industrial city above that, and they'll get certain things. So I know I've talked a lot about a chemical called PFAS. We don't have any PFAS in our water here, but I can guarantee, I'm 90% sure that the water in Provo has PFAS. But a lot of the taste comes from is the minerals. And so people do get used to those certain mineral content. And a good place to tell that is if you have a water softener. A lot of people will say, well, why does the water taste different out of the tap in the kitchen sink compared to the tap, let's say, in another part of the house? It's because when you soften water, you take out a lot of those minerals and it changes the taste.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So a lot of the taste has to do with the minerals in it, and also some of the organic chemicals that are in there. But we down here, we remove a lot of that through like our activated carbon.
Now, if you've ever gone to, say, Mexico or Central America or South America, that you always hear the phrase, don't drink the water, right? It's going to give you diarrhea. Mm-hmm. What are they not doing to the water that we are doing here? What's the main thing that makes us sick when we go down there?
The biggest one is pathogens. Mm-hmm. And so they don't remove those pathogens, or they don't treat for those pathogens, or a lot of times they might treat for it, but then their distribution system's not set up very well. So here at the water treatment plant, we have multiple different ways to treat for a pathogen, where a lot of times in those countries, let's say they have a well, and they'll just put a little chlorine in it. Well, chlorine does a really, really good job on certain pathogens, but not others. And so that's where you start to get in trouble. And so that's one of the reasons why the EPA here requires you to have multiple.
Okay.
The other thing is in the distribution system, we have chlorine all the way to your tap, basically. And so we're required to track that and make sure you have chlorine all the way through. Where those systems, they don't do that. And so as the water may be clean at one point, as it goes through the distribution system, it'll start to pick up pathogens along the way.
Through the pipes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So I could get really nerdy on this.
I think that's as deep as we need to go on it right there. I will say this. We stayed at a Verbo, actually, in St. Thomas. Mm-hmm. And spent some time at my son's house. So he was living there at the time.
Wow.
But one of the first things he said was, don't drink the water. And we're like, and I was thinking about all the chemicals and pathogens and all that stuff. And he said, no, you don't understand. We get our water. And he took me outside, and they have, I can't remember the word for it, but they basically have a slanted roof, and the water collects in a
cistern.
Yeah. And that's where they get their water in their houses. And I'm like, that doesn't sound very clean at all. Yeah. And apparently it's not. But you can cook with it, I guess. You're right. You heat it up and it'll kill most of the stuff. Or
yeah, if you boil it pretty good. Also, a lot of things in these other countries, though, like that do things like that. So we've talked about pathogens, but there's also a lot of chemicals that can hurt you. So we have very, very, very strict rules here in the U.S. about what can and can't be in the water. But if you have water that hits a roof, and let's say it's an asphalt shingle roof.
Right.
And so it hits that roof and then it rolls off that, it goes to a gutter, and then it goes into a cistern. That has too many hydrocarbons in there for the EPA standards for drinking water. Okay. Now, flushing a toilet, taking a shower, and all that other stuff would be fine. But here, just because those are made of, you know, a lot of tar paper, they would pick up that hydrocarbons. And so our system would pick that up.
Wow.
So there's some other things that can make you sick.
Can you imagine Zach in biology class in high school or college? And this is so cool. And everybody else is like, oh, man, this is so boring. So.
High school wasn't a good... You don't want to know me in high school. My academics kicked in college.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. That's all right.
I think in high school, you and I would have hung out.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Been buddies?
Yeah.
All right.
We would have had fun.
Yeah. That was a long time ago. I'm a little older than you, Zach.
Okay, that's...
Yeah. But we had... We had arcade games. Yeah, because I had to put money, go to the arcade.
The quarter.
Did you do that?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah. 49th Street Galleria in Salt Lake.
Oh,
I spent a lot of time and a lot of money there, more than I care to admit nowadays. Yeah.
I will say in college, I would spend usually about 12 hours a day studying.
Oh, so in college, but not in high school?
Not in high school.
Okay.
But in college, I really did focus and get dialed in and thrived.
And now look at you. You're the water czar.
Yeah, now I'm just Zach.
Well, thanks again for coming on today, Zach. Let's talk about water now here in the Washington County. I'm looking at this color code. And by the way, go to wcwcd.org to check it out. If you click on infrastructure, there's a really cool color-coded wheel. Thanks, by the way, Karen. that talks about something. Now, I want to start here with dams. We have water storage dams and we have diversion dams. What's the difference?
So a dam is exactly what you see where you go there and there's a big body of water behind it.
Right.
A diversion dam is generally something we put in the river that will back up water for just a little bit to basically back that water so we can redirect it into a pipe.
Okay.
And so if you went there and you saw it, you would see a big concrete structure that goes across the river, but you would see very little water backing up behind that.
So there's no lake behind it?
There's no lake. Yeah,
okay.
It's usually a little puddle at most.
And it says we have 9 water storage dams. Can you name all 9 of them? I'm going to put you to the test, Zach.
So should we start the one side of the county and go across the other?
Sure.
So of
course, I'm going to count, though.
Okay. So we have Kolob.
Kolob, of course.
Which is a phenomenal system or whatever you want to say.
That's important, Kolob.
Yeah. We have Ash Creek.
Okay, Ash Creek.
So we have Sand Hollow.
Sand Hollow.
Quell. We have Baker. We have Gunlock. We have Upper and Lower Enterprise.
That's 2, right?
Yeah, that's 2.
Okay, where are the 8 already then?
Gary, you got to help me with that. What am I missing one?
Number 9.
Oh, Sand Hollow and Quell Creek. Yeah, of course.
Okay, cool.
And my goals, I really do hope to build 4 more. So, and this is the perfect year to show why, because if we would have had those 4 extra dams built, we would have filled them all up.
We would have filled them up. And now we have to let all that water go because we're mostly full at this point.
Yeah, we're essentially we're full everywhere. We're spilling everywhere. So
I think I saw gun lock 104% or 106% or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Which of course means we have the beautiful Gunlock Falls and the overflow. Baker, I guess, is also overflowing, and you're having to let water go. Does that kill you? You're just like, I can't believe we have to let this water go. I'd love to put it somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I really wish we did have extra reservoirs where we can store it, because I just, like, this year is going to be great. We're going to get through this year, but I just don't know what next year is going to bring us. And that's, I always like to have a good savings account, and that's where dams are basically savings accounts for the future.
Okay, water storage tanks. It says we have 9 of them here. I can only think, in my mind, 3 or 4. Are some of them hidden, or just areas I don't go to? Or
yeah, some of them are completely buried, and so
really,
oh yeah. Depending on the design or the location, some do better buried, and some because of the soil type we can't bury. Like for example, the one at Warner Valley that we just built out there, it's quite prominent up there on the side of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
That was originally proposed to be buried.
Oh.
But when we get into the soils and realize what the soils are doing there, we realized we couldn't bury it, and so we just stuck it above the ground. But yeah, I mean, most people, pretty obvious. You have one just up here on the top of Bluff, that big green round tank. Mm-hmm. That's water. So if you start looking around, we usually paint them or do other things to kind of blend them in so people don't see them or bury them.
Right.
But if you start just driving around looking, you'd be surprised to see how many there are
around.
You
have to be aware of them, huh?
Yeah, you just
like when you buy a car and you never notice that model of car until you bought one, and now you see them everywhere.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I drive by one every day up on Red Cliffs Parkway.
Uh-huh.
On my way to back and forth from work. I live in Middleton. There's a big one in Middleton, too.
So when you drive, you're actually driving by 2 tanks.
2.
Yeah.
I only see one.
I know.
Where's the other one?
The other one's buried.
Like right by that one? Or?
Uh-huh.
Oh, there's 2 there.
Yeah.
And Carrie, did you know that? She knew that. Okay.
Yeah.
It's her job to know that.
Yeah, so that's just an example. And we kind of mentioned this earlier. The vast majority of our infrastructure is buried, and we kind of like to have it blend in. We like to, like, kind of keep it out of sight, and so it is not obtrusive. And so a lot of people just don't appreciate that.
Does that play into, like, the public relations of water management, or is that just what has always been done? Or, I mean, what's the main purpose behind that? Because I don't have a problem seeing some of the water stuff, but
it's a little change. I mean, if you go back and you look at, like, the 70s and the 50s and stuff like that, when they first started doing water infrastructure, they used to just stick those tanks up on some, like, the highest point.
Yeah.
And they would paint them like blue. They'd go and find the cheapest paint.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And they would paint them, and that's what they were. Nowadays, we try to be a better neighbor is maybe a better word for it, that we try to kind of blend things in. So, like, for example, if you go up by Anderson Junction as you're going up I-15, we just finished a big, large 3 million gallon tank up there.
Okay.
And we painted it. And the paint, they went and actually kind of selected a paint that would kind of blend in. So as you're driving up I-15, it just doesn't jump out and stare at you.
Right. It's there, but...
It's there.
Yeah.
So instead of going to the store and saying, we want the absolute cheapest paint possible, we go in and say, hey, what is the color that can blend in so it's not so obtrusive? And so
who makes that? Is that you making that decision?
No, no. That's
water people, huh?
That's usually the design engineer, and he'll go out and, I mean, it's not, we don't get too sophisticated with this one, just so you know. We kind of go out there with a bunch of different paint swabs and say, yeah, this one kind of looks
pretty
good.
Close.
It'll blend in okay. And then they go from there.
So a lot has been made of St. George Temple and the Salt Lake Temple getting refitted to be earthquake, more earthquake ready if we were to get one. How about the water infrastructure? What, I mean, we were talking about dams, we were talking about water tanks, and of course, 250 miles of pipe. If an earthquake were to strike southern Utah, heaven forbid, but if it were, and it was a big one, what kind of shape would we be in?
You're talking about my nightmares. So we have a plan in place. So that is a very big concern.
Yeah.
And so when we design things, we have certain levels that we design them to. And so they come and they say, okay, in this area, you have this much acceleration of the ground, basically of how fast the ground will shake during an earthquake. Mm-hmm. And then you give buildings certain assignments. And so like a typical house actually has a low assignment because they like, listen, if it's a smaller house, it doesn't take a lot. And so you rank them. And so like a hospital has to be built to the highest standards because they're like during an earthquake, you can't have a building like they, so they're built to really high standards.
Yeah.
The water district also, we have to build to the highest earthquake standards for our area that we can, and also our dams. So our dams are actually specifically designed to take ground movement and actually a shift and do a few things like that.
You know, shock absorbers kind of.
Yeah. But even during that, if an earthquake happens, we have a plan in place to basically get out and look at things as fast as we can and see what's going on. And depending on the size of, I mean, if it's a small little shaker, it probably is not that big a deal. Crack a few pipes here and there. But the big one is what we're really worried about, that is making sure our infrastructure is secure, because right after an earthquake, we generally have a lot of fires and a lot of needs. And so,
need water.
So this is where I've got to give the County Emergency Operations Center a lot of credit. We work very, very closely with them, and they run drills all the time of like, what are we going to do? How are you going to start prioritizing things? How do you triage things? Like, what time of year would be a massive difference on how things would work? But it is a big concern. We do plan for it, but it's always something there. And that's one of the reasons why I think people having those rain barrels in their garage, having about 55 gallons in their garage is not about, I mean, I have one. I think that is a good idea, because during a big earthquake, a lot of pipes just in the street will break and we'll have to shut that water line off.
So you have no water.
So you could have a neighbor that wouldn't have any water for a period of time and basically what we do is we go from the water treatment plant or a key well and then start just working down the chain to fix those. But it would be a big, big issue.
Be prepared, in other words.
Yeah, be prepared.
So if the water conservancy district guy says you should have a tank of water in your garage, a barrel of water, just in case, then you should have one.
I think those 72-hour kits that they talk about a lot are a really good idea.
Okay.
And a key crucial part of that 72-hour kit is having enough water stored that if the water goes off because of an earthquake for 72 hours that you'd be okay.
Yeah, not enough to take a bunch of showers in.
No.
You can pretend like you're French for a while and not take a shower for a week or two. Enough to that you can prepare food and have water to drink.
About 2 gallons of water per day per person is what the goal is.
Dr. Blodgett always tells me the rule of three. You get 3 minutes without air and you will die. 3 days without water and you will die. 3 weeks without food and you will die. Pretty good rules. So, all right, Zach, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more from the Water Conservancy District here on the Andy Griffin Show. Welcome back. We were just spending time reminiscing a little bit. Zach and I'm a little older than him, but not as much as maybe we thought.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah. So, and I was actually a disc jockey at a rock station. From 88 to 91, you graduated 91.
Yeah.
So I was playing your music, man.
Oh, I was listening, because that was before Apple Music and all this other stuff. So we relied on the radio a lot.
Now, what high school did you graduate from?
Weber High School.
Weber, okay.
Up in Ogden.
I was actually a DJ in Logan, because I was going to Utah State at the time, and I had graduated from broadcasting school and was playing rock and roll music on Z104.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We called it a history of hits from the 60s to the 90s, a history of hits on Z104.
So they're up by Hiram. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, sure.
So my neighbor owned a ranch up there, and so I'd go work on that ranch quite a bit. And so we totally listened to that when we were fixing fences.
There's a very good chance you heard my voice in all those years ago. I was a late guy. I usually came on at 9 p.m. Sometimes afternoons if the afternoon guy was busy, and then I was there until we would actually turn the translator the broadcasting off at 2 a.m. and it would be off from 2 to 6 until the morning guy came in. So and I got to play. It was kind of funny because I knew all the bosses were in bed after midnight, so I'd play whatever I wanted. So I'd play all my favorite songs, and I used to have guys call in and say, "Oh, I love your music, man. Where's your playlist from?" I'm like, "Hey, I'm just playing songs I like."
That's cool. That's good.
And I remember, maybe you remember this, I was at Z104 when I was doing my shift, and the music director for our station came running in, and he had a black CD case, and it had a lightning bolt cut out of it. And he said, "I got it." And I said, "You got what?" And he says, "I got the brand new AC/DC song." I said, "Oh, really? Well, what is it?" He says, "Well, here, let's play it. I've never heard it." And I'm like, "Well, is it okay to play it on the air?" He says, "Well, yeah, they sent it to me to play." So he opened it. It was black, and it had a lightning bolt cut out. And he opened it up, and I pulled it out, and it said Thunderstruck across the top of it. And I stuck it in the CD player and played it right there live on the air. And within 5 seconds, the phone lines all lit up. Everybody wanted to hear it again. I'm like, well, it's not even over yet. No, we want to hear it again. So anyway.
That's cool. Yeah. That's a good song.
I just remember that. So, all right, at 9:37, let's take some phone calls here on the show. Hey, you're on with Andy with Waters Director. Sorry, I like to call him. Zach Renstrom, what's up?
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
A couple questions. We've had some words from Washington about how they're solving the Washington, D.C., the water problem in Colorado River mm-hmm. by throwing $1 billion at it. So how do you buy extra water? Explain that if you can.
Yeah, good point, Zach, and good point. Is this Richard?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, Richard, thanks for calling. And that's a great question.
Oh, it's a great question, and I agree with the caller. I think it's a joke. But basically what they're doing is they're going to be paying farmers to not irrigate their fields. For a period of time.
We're going to bribe you to not grow corn and wheat and stuff.
Yeah, and I actually disagree with what they're doing because it's just a Band-Aid. They're not fixing the problem. They're just putting a Band-Aid on it. And so it's $1 billion Band-Aid. And I think if you're going to spend $1 billion, you should fix the problem.
That's a lot of money. That's $1,000 million for those of you counting it.
Well, and that gets back to why we have inflation.
Yeah.
Like yeah. So how
much is a Lake Powell pipeline?
$1 billion. Well, a little over. It's over $1 billion.
They could have just gone ahead and built that.
Yeah, but see, that's solving a problem. That's my whole thing.
It makes too much sense.
If you're going to spend $1 billion, fix a problem that needs to be fixed for a long time, and this is just a Band-Aid. So.
Somebody texted in, by the way, said, what about Pine Valley Water? How are they fixed for water up there compared to, say, down here in the valley?
So when they say Pine Valley, there's two Pine Valleys we like to talk about a lot. So there's the Pine Valley where Iron County is building a pipe up to, and then we have Pine Valley here in Washington County up by our mountains.
Different places.
Two different places, okay. Geologically far apart. So I'm going to talk about the place here in Washington County.
Okay.
Because I just want to avoid any of the confusion. So RA up there, the cabins up there, they get their water from wells. And as you go down the Santa Clara River, it's mostly wells. The water that's coming out Pine Valley, it flows down and it goes to Baker and people draw the river for irrigation all the way down through the system. This year, that system had a great snowpack. It actually came off a little bit faster than we thought. But it's actually a really good watershed. It's very pristine water. It has a couple of natural occurring things in it that we kind of watch, but it's just naturally occurring stuff like that. And so, but overall, it's a really good watershed and it's a really clean watershed.
Okay. Is Pine Valley done melting? Is there just still a bunch of snow up there?
There's still a bunch of snow on the shady sides of the mountain.
Okay, that's kind
of
what my dad was saying. I'm like, man, Pine Valley looks almost melting. He said, well, you should see the other side.
Yeah, the shady sides still have quite a bit of snow on there. But the flooding, the major things that we were so worried about flooding, it has come off beautifully. And so we're not as concerned anymore because most of the snow has been melted except for in the shady area.
I was up, as I mentioned, in northern Utah. Timpanogos is still completely cloaked in snow. And we maybe don't have to worry as much about flooding here this year, but they've got to be really concerned up in northern Utah.
They are, and they have seen flooding up there. But for the most part, it's also coming off really nice up there. And so I think besides small little regional flooding areas, I think we're going to be okay as a state for the most part.
Just got a text. Hey, Andy, please ask Zach, how in the heck does Sand Hollow Reservoir fill up? I don't see any rivers or large streams running into it. Thanks.
That is a great question. Mm-hmm. So every single drop of water that goes to Sand Hollow is pumped. And so we take water out of the Virgin River up by the city of Virgin, and we put it into a big pipe, essentially, and then we pipe that water into Sand Hollow.
How big is the pipe?
It's tall enough for me to walk through.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're not that tall. Could I walk through it? Is
I think you might have a problem.
At the stoop. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a big pipe, and we take that water, so we take it out of the Virgin River. So, yeah, every single drop of water in Sand Hollow is Virgin River water that was taken out of the river. Okay. And 90% of the water in Quail also comes through that same pipe.
Okay.
Yeah, good question.
Good question. Let's go back to the phone line. Hey, thanks for calling. You're on with Andy and with Zach. What's up?
Okay, so I had a few questions. One of them is, when I have a swimming pool outside for my dog, it starts to grow green stuff. So I'm wondering, if you have a barrel of water in your garage, does it start to grow green stuff?
Yes, it can. So if your dog's swimming in the pool, that's what's causing a lot of the green stuff. And so you have to treat the water. So if you're going to store water, and there's actually a lot of really good websites on there, that you can actually buy little tablets that you can put in the water to help keep it fresh. There's certain types
of... In the dog pool water, or are you talking about a barrel, if you keep a barrel in your garage?
I'm talking about a barrel that you would keep in your garage that's sealed.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's another thing is with it being sealed, it doesn't get oxygen as much. There's the tablets you can put in those barrels. You can add certain types of Clorox, but you have to be very careful with what... You have to be careful because some Clorox, they put perfumes in it and all that other stuff, and so you don't want to do that. But I'm talking about sealed containers that you can store. If it's out in the open, that's where you're probably getting a lot of that green stuff.
Okay, so then my other question would be, if I didn't have a big barrel, but I have a swimming pool, is there a way that I could heat my swimming pool water if I needed to?
So if you have a swimming pool, there's two options that you have there. So first of all, when I talk about the 2 gallons per day that you need, essentially 1 gallon you'll drink and 1 gallon you'll need for like hygiene, like cleaning. So a swimming pool would be an excellent source of water for somebody to do the basic hygiene cleaning stuff. For drinking, you don't necessarily, I mean, if it's a true dire emergency, you could drink the pool water. People that swim in it are drinking it. Generally, though, if you want to drink pool water, you'd probably want to run it through at least a little filter, and even a camping filter would really be helpful in a situation like that.
Yeah.
The main thing is that when you have pool water, you have certain chemicals in there to keep it looking really clean. So if you get a filter, find one with that activated carbon in there, because as the water goes to that activated carbon, it actually pulls out some of that the chlorine and a few other things out of there that would be helpful. But no, swimming pool would be a really good source of water during an emergency.
My other question is, can that green stuff, you know, if my dog's drinking that out of his pool that's got green in it, sometimes it goes a little longer before you clean it out. Can he get yeast in his body from that?
I'll tell you this. I don't know what kind of green stuff he's drinking, and I'm not a vet, so you'd probably want to ask the vet on that question.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Thanks.
I appreciate that. And interesting stuff. So the pool could serve as an emergency water source.
Yeah, especially for like cleaning. I mean, a pool, like if you had to wash your hands, what I would recommend somebody do is not wash your hands in the pool, but scoop some of that pool water out, go over to a wet area, and then clean your hands with that pool water with some soap. And that'd actually do a really, really good job doing that. I mean, if you had to, you could probably drink it for a while, but there are... It's not drinking water, it's swimming water. And so it could be a very good source. Or a hot tub. Like another good source of water is your hot water heater. Usually holds about 40 gallons of water. And so in an emergency, there's valves at the bottom of those hot water heaters, and you can turn that on and get that 40 gallons of water that you could drink. And so and I know this might sound a little bit gross, but most people have the toilet. And so you have water in the bowl, but then the tank above it usually holds about 2 gallons of water.
And that's still clean, right? It hasn't been in the bowl.
Yeah, you still have to look at that because it's been exposed to the air and a few other things, and sometimes a little bit of mold will grow in those a little bit. But still, it's wet water that you could at least look at and evaluate. So
now, you're not necessarily a pool expert, but what about a saltwater pool versus a chlorinated pool? In the long run, in an emergency, I have a saltwater pool at home.
So I would use it for hygiene. I wouldn't drink it. So, okay. And I don't know
much like ocean water, right? Yeah. It would actually dehydrate you.
Yeah, salt water is not good to drink.
Okay.
And so, but you could use it to like clean pots, like cooking utensils. I mean, even to, like I said, wash hands with. There's a lot of things you still could do. I just would not recommend drinking salt water at all.
There was, I don't know if you heard about this statistic, during COVID when everything was shut down for a while, 24% of Americans attempted to get a pool or hot tub during that time because we were all sitting at home bored, I guess. And a lot of people got one. I was actually lucky. We put one in right, it was finished January of 2020, 2 months before COVID hit, we got our pool done. So we were really lucky. In fact, we had some good quality time with our teenage girls during the COVID shutdown, sitting in the hot tub. So,
well, good for you guys.
Very cool. So we're with Zach Renstrom today talking water, infrastructure, pools.
Yeah.
We'll talk about anything, toilet water and drinking it or not. We'll be right back. It's a Wednesday. What a beautiful day today, though. It's like 76 degrees outside and a slight breeze. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show to Zach Renstrom. He is our Water Conservancy district president and manager and czar and leader and all that stuff. And
just
he's
Zach.
also a lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You still got your law license and everything?
Yeah. Every once in a while, it comes in handy.
But do you practice law occasionally?
I get threatened to be sued probably once a week. So
that doesn't count.
Nobody
comes to you and say, hey, I'm getting divorced, Zach, can you handle it? Nothing like that.
No, I do have friends or family that'll call me up, and I don't, but I always kind of listen to them just to be nice, and then I usually refer them out really quick.
Yeah, good move. Yeah.
So
you could bill them $350 an hour.
Yeah, I won't do that.
No.
But
okay.
I guess I can write my own will.
Let's go to the phone lines. I think Gil is hanging on, our county commissioner. You there, Gil?
Oh, Gil.
Hey, what's
I am.
Up?
Good morning.
Hey.
Hey, Gil.
Great for the knowledge you've given us and synopsis. And I wondered if you'd touch on something, a lead-in and then a question. You've had a very successful grass replacement program. Mm-hmm. And many people have been taking advantage of that and getting a rebate. I had a call the other day, I think I mentioned this to Zach, but everyone should know about this, from somebody in Hurricane who thought the county was the water district and explained that, but their question was, why didn't I get the rebate? And I applied and I couldn't get it. And I said, well, where do you live? And he said, Hurricane. Well, I guess Hurricane hasn't signed on with all of the countywide water conservation ask, and therefore they didn't get the advantage of the rebate. So could you explain a little bit about that, Zach? And I'll get offline so I can just listen.
All right. Thanks, Gil.
Yeah. So what we're doing is the state of Utah has come in and basically said, if you want this money to help with the grass rebate, you need to make sure the city has passed certain conservation measures. Because the theory is we're not going to pay somebody to rip out grass and then another person go and plant 2 acres of grass. And so we're kind of following the state guidelines on that. And also my board got together and said, okay, kind of taking the lead from the state requirements, we're going to kind of follow that. And the key thing is what we're really trying to do is double our money here. So the state legislature has authorized multi-millions of dollars for grass rebate, but they put some rules and regulations on that, and we want that money. And so we're trying to double it. And so basically we're working with the state. We have been working with Hurricane. I am hopeful that, and they're in the process of reviewing everything, but I'm really hopeful that they'll be able to tweak a few things so the citizens out there can start taking advantage of that here shortly. Because it's been interesting to me to see the huge demand we have for that program, I should say.
So as of this moment, if you live in Hurricane, you are not eligible for a grass rebate?
As of this moment, yes, but I think that'll change shortly.
Okay. What if I live in Ivins?
Or you would qualify Santa
Enterprise,
Clara.
Even.
So Enterprise, not yet.
Okay.
If the city of Enterprise tweaked and followed the state requirements and also worked with the water district's requirements, people up in like Enterprise could qualify. I know Springdale has reached out to us extensively because they want to start taking advantage of that program. And so we're working with them. So even though we don't necessarily deliver any water in Springdale, those citizens would be able to qualify for it also once their city tweaks it. And I think they would too.
Zach, what's the word for the grass between, say, a driveway or sidewalk and the curb? Is that the strip?
The grass strip. Yeah.
Grass strip. Anyway. Yeah. There was I was listening to radio up in Orem, and they were talking. There was some company that said, we'll rip out your strip or rip the strip or
flip
something
the strip.
Like that. Yeah, that's the one. Flip the strip. Has that caught on here? Is that something that we're trying to do too?
So we do have that program. We are being a little bit more aggressive down here because they're just ripping out a small little section four feet wide and a little bit. But we're saying, no, we want you to look at the entire yard. So we're actually being a little bit more aggressive down here than they are up there. And also up there, they just have those little grass strips everywhere. And we actually don't have as many here. And basically down here, we put the sidewalk right up against to the curb, where up north, there's usually the curb and gutter, and then there's usually a 4, sometimes even a 10-foot strip, and then the sidewalk. And we haven't done that as much down here.
I'm looking across the street here at Sandtown, though they have a pretty big strip, but they also have trees in there.
Yeah. Well, so parks, like that park right there, that is functional grass. I mean, you probably see kids out there playing out.
Like, soccer, the Scottish games, all that stuff. Yeah.
So I like that grass, we think is great. Because it is being utilized as a functional grass. And so if grass is being used, if people are enjoying it, that's not the grass we're talking about. We're talking about the ornamental grass that only gets touched when people mow it.
Has anybody sat down and done the math as far as the rebate versus the cost? Like if I just got your basic, say I had a small strip, a 10 by 10 strip of grass that I wanted to get out, and that's pretty small, but maybe 10 by 20, let's say 10 by 20. Do you have an estimate of how much rebate would I get for that, and how much would that actually cost me? Do you know?
So we will give up to $2 a square foot. And so we basically go out there and measure it, and then we'll say, okay, you have this many square feet, so this is the amount of the rebate.
So the 10 by 20, that's 200 square feet, right? Yeah. So we're talking about $400.
$400. And talking to people and the landscapers, if someone does it on their own, so they want to just do-it-yourself project, then the $2 would pay for the material. So if you go down to like one of the nurseries and get it, it would cover that. If you go and hire somebody, generally a landscaper, and it depends a little bit on the rock you choose and plants and all that stuff, but they're charging usually around $6 plus. And so you would have to kind of fill that $4 gap. But if you do it yourself, then the $2 would cover it.
But we're not talking artificial turf. We're talking like if we didn't like a xeriscape, like rocks and trees and stuff like that.
Yeah, so it's important to note, too, this is not just rip out grass. This is a landscape conversion.
Okay.
And so if you rip out the grass...
You can't just leave dirt there.
You can't leave dirt. And that's another thing. We go out and measure it and say, yeah, this is the grass you can remove. Then you call us and we come back and say, and then we look at it again. So if you rip it out and put in concrete, you wouldn't qualify for the program. Because we don't want the heat island effect going
on.
Right. And that's the big thing. And so if you ripped it out and like planted a tree, that would be like trees are awesome. Like we want desert friendly trees.
Yeah. But not palm trees.
Well, it depends on the palm.
Okay.
that's part of it. So
that's
but
a whole other story. Yeah. We don't have time to talk about palm trees today. So
I'll get the biologist for the arborist for that. But if they want to do artificial grass too, we will work with them on that. So we try to be flexible. If somebody's ripping out grass, but they're putting some trees and do some other things like that, we really will work with them. And so if they rip it out and put some artificial turf in, we will work with them.
We had two big stretches in our yard. In our side yard, we took out real grass and we put in artificial turf. And it's actually kind of a nice little area there. Yeah. We've got lawn chairs and things. But we do have some area in our front yard that is grass. Not real big, but... I hate to say it, but I think it only gets used to be mowed. So we might be one of those people that needs to address that and figure out what we need to do on
that. It's easy. Just go to our website. There's the application. They go to our conservation. They can fill it out. We have had a lot of people express interest in it. So we're actually in the process of hiring some interns for us to help kind of speed up the process to get people out there. And we're also looking at some technologies that we might be able to use.
And again, and Zach didn't say it, but I will go up to the Desert Gardens up there on Red Hills Parkway and take a look. It doesn't have to be ugly. It doesn't have to be, you know, just rocks and gunk, you know, and metal sculptures. You can make it really pretty with some vegetation.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, like, right now it's beautiful out there because everything's blooming. But even in the middle of the summer when it's just really hot, you'll go out there and it's actually fairly cool because of the trees and... some of the other vegetation that's going on out there, it does really keep that cooling effect down. So like during the summertime, when I have a long phone call, I will actually go out there and walk around in the middle of July, and it's actually not bad at all.
Final minute, I did want to ask you about your landscape workshops. What are those, and should people get involved? Are they interested in those?
Yeah, so there's always a lot of questions that people have, and they're really good questions. And so we have two people that are full-time. That one runs the Tonopah Garden, one runs the Desert Garden, and it's just workshops that they can sign up with and kind of learn more about whatever. Sometimes it's vegetables, and sometimes it's trees.
Go to wcwcd.org to check it out. Thank you, Zach.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Great job.